If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I've always been like an advocate for not criminalizing gang members, because we are all victims of PTSD. I've had someone explain, like one of my friends was saying to me, but I'm a soldier the same way a real soldier is in the army, and they have to go to war and they come back with PTSD and potentially get help, whereas we're not getting any help. We have PTSD. Where do we go for this help? And, you know, people say about violence on the streets, but, you know, hurt people hurt people.
Danielle was a County Lines dealer before it was even termed County Lines. She was at the forefront of that new industry. She saw things that were unimaginable. She's had things done to her that are unimaginable. This is Top Girl, an incredible new book that you definitely need to read. You need to hear Danielle's story. This is like no other insight you could possibly get into the drug trade. So let's get on with this. This is Stop and Search on Scroobius Pips Distractions Pieces Network, brought to you by Acast in association with UK. Here we go. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where to bow the southern stream. Thank you so much for joining us. We're talking Top Girl, an amazing new book. Please go out and read it. We barely scratched the surface in this podcast. There's so much more detail that we could have talked about. We're joined by Danielle herself, the person that told this story. It is her story, it's her life. And what a life she's had. She was on County Lines before it was County Lines. She's seen the absolute worst of society, but also the best in her own words. She's had an interesting life, but yeah, there's some details as well that must have been incredibly hard to tell. So that's why you need to read the book. So thank you so much, Danielle, for your honesty, your eloquence, your bravery, everything. Thank you so much for what you bring to this discussion. And thank you to Robin Eveleigh, who is the ghostwriter of this book. He is a journalist and author. He has written for Vice, The Sun, and also some publications which he mentions in this podcast as well, which I think is quite interesting. So thank you, both of you, for what you did for this podcast. And quick caveat from me, I've got a cold during this podcast, so please excuse the snuffly tones from me. Find us on all the usual social media channels at UK Leap on Twitter, Facebook, blah blah blah, you know the score. So let's get straight on with this. This is Top Girl. Wow, what a story. Right, so I'm joined by Danielle and Robin, who have written the most incredible book, and I do say that genuinely, because I read this really quickly and it just absolutely captivated me. It was just incredible to read this story of Danielle's. It's called Top Girl. And if it's all right with you two, I want to start chronologically. So Danielle, firstly, thank you so much for writing this book, because it is just so, so crucial, moving and just eloquent as well. But I love the way it started, because it is, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but the overriding premise at the start of the book is you were taught respect for the police, weren't you? That it was in your culture and in your background that the police had a level of respect, community relation. So can you give me a bit of background on your background, both in terms of how you grew up and your relationship with the community, but also with the police?
My relationship with my community was always very strong. And I think it is, I can't speak for any other areas of England, but especially like inner city London, the community feel, especially in the 90s, was very strong. You know, we all knew each other. It was like an open door policy in our estate. You know, everyone's door was kind of open. Everyone knew each other. There was none of that kind of, you know, don't go outside sort of thing. We were encouraged to go outside and be kids and play. With the police, they were always, again, it was always a factor in my childhood. I think because of where I lived, the police were always very visible. Like, I've never not known them or seen them around. As a very young child, it was always, my mum would say hi to them, hello, hello, and they'd say hello. And, you know, that was quite normal. And I had respect in the sense of, you know, respect the older generation and like people working and things like that. So yeah, I didn't have any interactions with them per se until I got slightly older, but there was a level of respect there. Yeah. And I think that comes from not just my culture, but also where we grew up. We just saw them around.
And you mentioned that you come from London. It was a different community to how it is today. You mentioned early on in the book that, you know, you didn't have screens per se back then. So what was that like growing up in the streets then?
Lovely. Like, I've got very fond childhood memories of just being outside, doing normal childhood things like mud pies and just playing in the little playground and having all our friends around and, you know, like having little knocks and bangs, like playing, like running around in the streets. It was just great. Like, and as the book starts, which was Rob's idea, which was great, it starts really well. That was normal. Like, those sorts of things were happening all the time. And London was a great place to live. That's what I thought. It's definitely changed now. And I'm glad that I was able to sort of experience that time, which was just before the internet and before phones and things like that, where now our children are a bit more, I don't know, maybe not fearful of outside, but maybe as parents, we're a bit more fearful to let them outside. Whereas back then, we were encouraged. So, yeah, great childhood.
You just mentioned Robin there, so say hello to Robin. As the ghostwriter of this book, at what point did this get flagged up for you? What point did you start become aware of Danielle's story?
So I heard Daniel talking on, it was either a podcast or a radio back in, I think it was July, summer 2019. And I remember vividly driving along in the car and hearing her. I think I was playing this show through my phone, through the car speaker. And I'd been looking for a County Line story for some time. I'd been, because no one at that point had really done a memoir from the point of view of someone who'd been involved in County Lines, either as an exploited child or as a gang member. It hadn't really been done. And I'd approached a few different charities trying to find someone who they had perhaps helped exit from a gang or someone in their care who might be willing to speak to me. And I hadn't really, I tried kind of half-heartedly and I hadn't really got very far, probably because they want to save, you know, they're keen to safeguard people in those kind of situations. And then when I heard Danielle speaking, I knew instantly that she was going to have a story to tell. And not only that, because by that time she'd kind of been out by for maybe 2.5-3 years. And I think by then she was able to kind of take a bit of a step back from it. And she was able to, she had an opinion about what she'd been through. So she wasn't just talking about her experience, she had an opinion about it and she was able to express it intelligently. And as someone who's going to be spending a lot of time interviewing someone with that experience, that's exactly what you want. You don't want someone who's going to be difficult to interview and going to kind of clam up or not be able to express an opinion.
So what is your background, Robin?
I've been a journalist now, it's going to make me sound really old, since the early 90s.
Oh, wow.
So I think 92, 93. And I came up in a very traditional way through a local newspaper for a couple of years. I then went to a tabloid press agency. And then I moved to Brazil. I went freelance in Brazil for a few years, back to London in 2001. And since then, I've been freelancing mainly for national newspapers. And I've done a lot of stuff for the weekly women's magazines, which they kind of get sniffed at a little bit. There's a little bit of snobbery about them. But they're very, for people who want to do projects like this, ghostwriting projects, they're really good training ground because they teach you to kind of write in scenes. They get you very used to interviewing people and then writing their experience in the first person, because they're essentially a little, each feature you do for them is like a little ghostwriting exercise.
No, that's fascinating, because from our side, if you want to do outreach, you've got to get to new audiences, and those demographics are exactly where you need to get. So
yeah,
that's fantastic you write for those.
Yeah.
And I like the fact, coming back to you, Danielle, that we'll get into the story in a moment, but the process for me, I'm really interested as well, because you had to go through a lot of your past for this book. How was it for you going through that?
Do you know what? Since I kind of like left, I've done like public speaking here and there, and I've obviously done years of like counselling, CAMS, things like that. So in my own head, these, like, my life became a story, if you know what I mean. I was just spitting it out, kind of thing, because I'd said it so many times, and I used to get the comment a lot, oh, you speak so openly and you seem almost blasé about everything. And I think that's just because I have like regurgitated it over and over to like multiple agencies. But when we started the book and we were doing the interviews, it was the first time I really took it in, because I'd never said it in chronological order for a start. It was always like, we want to hear the rape story, or we want to hear the drug story. But where I went back right from the beginning and spoke about it in terms of years, it was interesting, because I've always been someone that has never seen myself as a victim until I started doing the interviews for the book, because it made me realise, oh my God, like, this led to this, and then this led to this. And it was like it all became very clear in my head, like, maybe I was a bit of a victim in that situation more than I realised at the time. So it was interesting. And it was difficult, but at the same time, I was really happy to get it off my chest, and I was happy to turn it into something that might help others. So it wasn't as hard as I thought it would be emotionally.
So having that retrospective is, and I'll get into some of the details in a moment, but it must have been enlightening for both of you to have that, just going through that process, and especially with regards to complex PTSD and things like that. You make a fantastic point in the book that a lot of gang members, and I'm going to caveat that with you, gang members, which we'll get back to, a lot of gang members do suffer from complex PTSD and lots of other variants. Can you explain a little bit about that?
I've always been like an advocate for not criminalising gang members, because we are all victims of PTSD. I've had someone explain, like, one of my friends was saying to me, but I'm a soldier the same way a real soldier is in the army, and they have to go to war and they come back with PTSD and potentially get help, whereas we're not getting any help. We have PTSD. Where do we go for this help? And, you know, people say about violence on the streets, but, you know, hurt people. And it's not all about, people are being criminal because they want to be. There's a lot of hurt people out there, and especially hurt men, and they don't know where to turn. So, yeah, I've had multiple men cry and break down and say they can't cope, and it's hard to see.
And the reason I caveated the gang member aspect is because you make it quite clear that it isn't as simple as that. You know, there's tribalism that goes with being raised on the streets, but to just lump it in to being a gang culture is far more complex than that. So can you give a little bit of explanation on that?
Yeah, I mean, I never... We used to, I never saw myself as a gang member. I saw myself as a part of a community. Obviously, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're being labelled a gang, you are going to own that. So, yeah, we will take ownership of that and we will say we're a gang and we will call ourselves a name and things like that because that's been pushed onto us. You know, there's a lot of kind of hype around this thing of being initiated into a gang and things like that. I have always said I've never experienced that. But one thing I would say is that not all gangs operate the same across London or England. So in the particular gang I was associated with, there was no such thing as like an initiation ceremony. So I think gang, I get it. Like technically, if you look it up in the dictionary, we are a gang. It's a group of people who have a common interest. And that is true. So I can understand why that sort of narrative has been placed on people. But me, I didn't see myself as a gang member.
And just rolling back a little bit, Robin, the process of writing for you, I can only imagine what it was like, because being a reader, you can't help but get drawn into these experiences and just, yeah, it's both enlightening humour at many times, but also just absolute, yeah, the rawest of emotion that goes with this book as well. What was it like for you hearing the stories and having to put that down on paper?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest, I don't want to sound like the great I am, but it didn't feel like a challenge. And that's mainly due to Danielle being, you know, so strong in interviews. I do come at this with years of experience, so I'm very used to sitting down with people who've been through very traumatic experiences, you know, people who've lost loved ones to murder, victims of sexual offences. So in terms of that kind of emotional challenge, that's something I'm quite used to. But Danielle always gave very good interviews and very quickly got the grasp of, you know, how much the kind of level of detail that we were going to need to go into, because it is a level above, you know, what I'm used to writing, say, for magazines or newspapers, to get that kind of colour and that emotion. You always want an emotional response to something that's happened. So, you know, the question is always, you know, how did that make you feel? And, you know, Danielle was always able to articulate that. And so it made the job very easy. I totted up, we did about 35, 40 hours worth of interviews. But actually, the writing process, once we sold the book, it was quite quick, really. We started in April and it was done by the end of July, I think it was. So it was, yeah, April, May, June, July. It was 4 months, yeah.
And what were those sessions like when you was interviewing Danielle? Was it as intimate as what I can imagine, going through the information that you must have had to have exchanged?
Yeah, of course. It was like we're talking now. And again, Danielle was always very open about the experience. And it was obvious that she'd talked about it before, so that helped. But yeah, it was a difficult subject matter and she handled it really well.
So one of the hooks of the book is that you're a grammar school person that had high grades, high level of intelligence, that then took the route that you did, which we'll get into in a moment. So what was that like being, you know, in that process of going to a grammar school? You compare it to Hogwarts, which is just brilliant, because I've got places around me that are exactly like that. So coming through those doors of, you know, moneyed students and people that weren't from your background, what was that like?
It was really difficult. I think when you're around people that we just weren't living the same life, me and my friends at school, we were not living the same life. Like I described in the book about one girl getting a horse as a Christmas present, or a pony. And I was just like I said in the book, I didn't believe her. I was like, I just don't believe you, because in my world, that is not a thing that happens. I found it very difficult to fit in. And I think when it's you know, it's great. Every parent wants their kid to go to, you know, a great school and get an education. Like, that's a huge privilege. And I'm happy in that sense that I got such a good basis of education. But for me, like, traveling so far to get to school was also another barrier to me making friends. I had no school friends in my area. And I think looking back now, it kind of actually did push me down that route a little bit more than maybe if I'd just gone to a local state, because I was actively trying to rebel, because I was like, I don't want to be like these girls. I don't want to be in this environment. I don't enjoy it. And so I think, yeah, it did subconsciously push me maybe the wrong way.
And you admit in the book that you didn't try that hard within the schooling process, but your grades were still exceptional. Yeah, you still did really well. So if you always been aware, this could be a really stupid question, but if you always had aware that you've had a high functioning intelligence?
It's so weird to like compliment yourself. Like, no, not really. Like, I've never thought I was anything, you know, like, I'd never thought I was the most intelligent. I wasn't the most intelligent. I wasn't top of the class. But I think it shows that I do, you know, I've got quite a focused mind, because I didn't try at all. And I still managed to get, you know, really good grades and go on to do great things. So, yeah, I didn't think I was that intelligent, but I do look back and I do feel grateful that I went to that school in terms of just the education alone.
So the process for you, as you said, the feeling like an outsider within the framework of that schooling system. You did hint at it there, that it almost pushed you to find another tribe. How much of that did provide an influence of what was to come?
I think quite a lot. I mean, I think some of it came from just the background that I was from and the people that I was seeing and my original friends. And then the other part did come from, you know, being in a school where it was a girls' school, there was a lot of bullying going on. And I got lumped with like the people that were, you know, like grammar schools, they will accept people that didn't necessarily pass the entrance exam, but are, I don't know, they've got like special circumstances. I was like with those people, you know, the people that we weren't really meant to be here, even though I did pass the entrance exam. So I was from the start banded with the people that were like not good enough to be in this school. And it also pushed me down that route in terms of no pastoral support in the school. Maybe if they'd stepped in at the right time and done the right thing when certain things were going on in my wider world, it may have changed my view. I mean, like, I could have gone to sixth form. Maybe if I'd gone to sixth form there, I wouldn't have been doing what I was doing. But I chose not to go because I didn't feel like I received any support from that school, from the safeguarding to the, like, what they called year, head of year, no support at all.
From your side, Robin, one of the hooks of this story is that Danielle, a grammar school girl that had brilliant grades, but then went on to counter-lise drug dealing, and that's a really big shorthand hook for it. What has been the reaction when you've relayed this to people in the media, people in your circles? What kind of reaction have you had to this?
I think it's too early to say in terms of that reaction, but I think what it does show is, you know, as Danielle said, it shows that this, you know, anyone can be dragged into this, literally anyone. And again, as she said, you can see a very clear chronological pathway from feeling kind of outside and uncomfortable in her own skin or with her surroundings in grammar school, thinking, I don't want to be here. I'm going to spend time with this lad and hang around with him while he's dealing weed instead. And then from there, kind of branching out into his wider circle of friends. And from there, really becoming kind of brutalized to some extent by street life and some of the experiences that she saw on the street. And I think with each step, she kind of reached I'm talking about in the third person. Danielle reached a kind of a new normal of a new level of kind of normality in terms of what she was willing to take on. And it, you know, with each step that she willing to take on more and to put herself into more and more extreme situations.
I'm really conscious about that as well, Daniel, of talking about you as opposed to you.
Yeah,
because,
sorry.
Because it's true that it so comes across both in the book, but also your presence now, that you know you know exactly what you're doing. You're very, very thoughtful in the processes that you've gone through, both in the writing of this book. But also, I love the way that certain things have been explained, because I do think there are certain things that just don't get the recognition that they deserve with regards to circumstances. And you make it clear that you were aware of weed dealing, addiction was very, very clear on the streets as well. Can you speak a little bit about that, of what you saw in your upbringing?
Again, like as I said earlier, growing up in inner city London, it's just part of the scenery. It's just normal to see nitties, as I would have called it back then, outside the bookies. Like, that was just normal. Like, seeing people slumped over on the floor with a, like, bottle in their hand, completely normal. Like, I remember one day going into someone's block and it was just covered in blood. In the lift, in the block, and it just had blood everywhere. And I remember my mum being like, don't touch anything. Like, do not touch anything. And we went downstairs and there was like a man like slumped on the side, just literally covered in blood. Just, yeah. So like things like that were just, it was just the scenery. It's just the backdrop of London. Like, that's all I've ever known. I only talk about London because I hadn't been anywhere else in my childhood. So for me, that London life was everything I knew. And it was just, it didn't even faze me at all. It was just normal.
So you call them nitties, and it's a term that I've not heard before. So someone that's, you know, that's the typical emblem of addiction, you know, someone that may have lost teeth and disheveled. So the fact that you were so aware of addiction at that age, how did that affect you and the people around you? Did it just become something you saw? Was it just a case of, you know, that's what drugs does, or that's what society does? How was it handled within your psyches?
Firstly, I just want to say that it's like, it's a very derogatory term, and like, I wouldn't use it now in my everyday life. But yeah, I think it was, I never blamed society. We always blamed drugs. Like, that was like very well known, like, this is a drug addict. And I think from an early age, it made me realise that, it's going to sound really weird, but I'd rather sell drugs than take drugs. Because I'd literally seen all these people that, and it sounds horrible, but, you know, weren't clothed well, weren't taking care of themselves. And then with the parallel, you'd see this drug addict standing next to a drug dealer who looked great, you know, had their car parked there. So I've, like, from an early age, it was always sell drugs over buy drugs, which, yeah, is not great.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. What were the community pillars of like with regards to the people that were dealing drugs? Were they the stereotypical flash car, flash clothes, jewellery? Was that what you saw?
Yeah, it was like 90s vibes. Like, you know, they were wearing like Avarex jackets, which was like the cool thing at the time. I can't remember the watch that it was called. It was called like a Patrick something. It was like a watch that all like the boys in my area were wearing, typical like jewelry, BMW 3 Series was like the car, or like a Honda Civic. If you had that car, you were like really cool. And these were the people that we were looking up to, and we were actively taught to put down the drug addicts. Like, we'd be like if one of our friends were like going too near, we'd be like, stay away from the nitty, and like we'd shout at them, and you'd get bullied kind of if you went near them. So from early, there was like a pressure to not be that, basically.
And Robin, for someone that's covered drug stories for as early as what you have, what's been the evolution like for you, having seen it from the early 90s to this day and age? Has there been a change, or is it just exactly the same, just different clothes?
I think with Danielle's story really defied expectations for me, because I thought I was going to be coming to a story about, very much about victimhood, about someone who was very, you know, like this traditional county line story that we hear about kids being coerced in. So either she was coerced herself, or she was involved in coercing kids. And so it was really interesting to hear that story told from the point of view of someone who was actively wanting to get involved with it. Yeah,
that's a really good point, actually, because when I was telling my friends and colleagues about this, is that there was you took this route knowingly, didn't you, Danielle? You wanted to go this route. So can we speak a little bit about that now? Of this is going to be a very broad question, but at what point did you consciously decide, actually, this might be for me?
I think literally when I got that first, I think it was like a £50 note, and I'd never seen a £50 note, and I was just like, this is the easiest thing ever. Like, why would I not do it? It was like an epiphany. Like, there was no other option for me. Why wouldn't I do this? It was almost like, if you choose to do something else right now, you're just stupid, because this is literally a legitimate way to make money. And from then, I mean, I wasn't like all in, like, I'm going to do everything I can to sell drugs. It wasn't like that. It was just a natural progression to like where I was asking to go to country and being like, no, I need, this is something I need. However, at the time, yeah, I was very headstrong and this is what I wanted to do as a career. Looking back now, I feel like maybe I was looking for something to distract me, and that's the reason. So I hold my hands up to say, yes, I did choose this, and I don't feel like one person coerced me into this, but I do think life coerced me into that.
So yeah, you were asking about like covering drug stories and whether I thought it had changed. In I don't think that the rhetoric has changed, because we newspapers or mainstream media are always talking the way they talk. It's always demonizing drug dealers and drug users. You know, they talk about, dealing death and evil drug dealers. And what something I really wanted to do with Danielle's story was to, like, drug dealers, they're just, to them, it's just a job. And that came across when speaking to Danielle. It got to a point, now remember, she was doing this for 5 years, and it really was, it was a job. There was no like higher cause behind it or anything. And so I guess I wanted to show that like drug dealers are normal people too. They have the normal worries and concerns about family life and boyfriends and girlfriends and, you know, having enough money to buy presents for their kids and all that everybody else does. And really it is just a job, and they're just trying to make the way, you know.
I think that's a really important point to make, is that it especially gets highlighted in the book that these aren't the other person that we're dealing with. These are normal people that have had life circumstances, and that the industry is there. So therefore, they're fulfilling a niche. And a lot of it comes with morals as well, which does get spoken about in the book. And Danielle, you were doing County Lines before County Lines was even such a thing. What was that like, the processes of what you were doing at that time?
I think I started off, you know, with not a huge amount of knowledge, maybe more knowledge than the average person. But I wasn't aware of like the inner workings of a County Lines operation. It was because it is, that's literally what it is. It's a business structure and a business model, and that's quite rigid, that you have to stick with that. And it's the same as any other self-employed person. Like, you've got profits to make, you've got profit margins, you've got losses, you've got, you know, all of these things that you have to learn and pick up along the way. And I wouldn't say like you're taught it, but you are. There's certain rules that you are taught and that you need to follow, certain regulations and things like that. And like Robin said, I literally saw it as a 9-to-5 that was not a 9-to-5. It was 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But it was my job and I took it seriously.
Can you explain what the first process that you took part in was, the wrapping? So what can you just, because there will be a lot of people that have got no idea what that involves. What is that?
I loved it. It sounds so bad, but it was literally therapeutic to me. Like, so we would go to a trap house and we would literally wrap up drugs for hours and hours to the point where like your fingers are forming scabs on them because you're touching so much heroin and it's just eating away at your fingers. And we would just rap. And like, I remember everyone used to say, you have the best rapping skills. My rocks were always super, super tight. And I mentioned in the book that I took pride over that. Like this was my, I was good at it. I enjoyed doing it. And it was important because rapping is such an important part of the process, because if you don't wrap those drugs correctly and you have to swallow them, you could potentially really harm one of your friends. You know, if it's got to be banked, as we would say, which is like putting it inside you, it's got to be wrapped really properly. So I took it seriously.
And it's made quite clear that you probably have got OCDs because of various different reasons. Did that play a part within your dealing process as well?
Oh, the OCD thing has got so bad. Like, literally, it only sort of come at it. I saw so much. Like, it wasn't necessarily from the wrapping. It was from, like, seeing unclean and unsanitary situations, which made, and being in these situations, it just made me go the opposite way. Like, I want to be very clean now. And, like, and even, I suppose it did come out a bit when, like, the wrapping up process was going on, because all my PEBs would be, like, in straight lines of 10. So I'd know when I've got 1,000 because it's 10 of 10. Whereas everyone else's would be scattered around and they're trying to like switch, what's it called? Like separate them out into thousands. Mine were already in thousands. Like, so yeah, I think it helped a bit, but it's definitely, the OCD's got a lot worse as time went on.
I think it makes complete sense. The way it's explained is that, yeah, that the processes that you saw and also what you've been through as well, it completely makes sense. I hold my hands up, I've got my own issues because of various different reasons. And the way that it is explained in the book, Robin, it must have been interesting to you to work out these thought patterns and these non-thought patterns as well, you know, these intrinsic reasons why certain character habits form. What was it like for you, Robin, having to listen to that and get it down in print in some sort of way and try and do it justice? And as we both commented, not talk about Danielle in any kind of patronising manner. How difficult was the writing process in general?
Well, again, mostly easy. I would say it was mostly easy because Danielle was very good at telling her story and relating her experience. I think that 5 years when she was in country was, I think at the beginning when we were talking about it, I was thinking this might be a little bit challenging because I think that period was, it was very intense, and I think in some respects it kind of all blurred into one long drug dealing period. And at the beginning it was sometimes difficult to draw out individual moments or little anecdotes that kind of that illustrated that and kind of held a kind of narrative drive through those 5 years. And also, I think, again, this comes back to the fact that it was kind of really just a job. I think if you went to work in, say, like an abattoir for a day, you would probably remember that for the rest of your life. You would remember the sounds of the animals. You would remember the conveyor belt and the smells and all the sights. I think if you spent 5 years doing it and someone asked you what it was like, you would probably struggle to, you know, it would just be, I worked in an abattoir.
That's a really good comparison. I'm going to throw to Danielle on that point in a second, actually. But just to get another point of view, Robin, is that at any point you mentioned that, you know, the fact that you have got a background in journalism like you have, did you take to bed any of this with you? Did you sit there and think at night, I can't believe what I just heard? Or were you able to get it all down on paper and leave it on paper?
Yeah, so I think that with experience, you do learn to kind of step away from the story and to leave it on the page to some extent. And if you're dealing with quite difficult subject matter, traumatic subject matter, so if you're interviewing families of murder victims or survivors of historic sexual offences on a regular basis, if you weren't able to do that, I think it would just send you mad. But having said that, I'm sure, you know, every journalist would say there are certain stories which forever, for whatever reason, stay with them, you know, sometimes for years. I can think of one I'm working on at the moment with the family of a young murder victim, and we've been in touch for almost a decade now. And Danielle's story, it is certainly one of those. You know, I can think of times when I would go to bed at night having worked late on the book, and I would lie awake either because of the emotional impact of the kind of stuff Daniel was talking about, or because I was kind of turning over a passage or a chapter in my head. And yeah, I don't think you can fail to be moved by the power of Danielle's story. And it's one that will always stay with me, I think.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Sorry, I want to ask you, Danielle. You lived this life for many, many years. Did you become acclimatized to it? The horrors that you saw, you know, you saw gunfights at the OK Corral. You saw the epitome of addiction and what it does to someone. You saw death round the corner at every single street. What was, it's a stupid question again, but what was that like?
It's hard to answer it, because to me, I just feel, and it's actually a symptom of PTSD, I feel no emotion. And that's not because I don't care, and it's not because I don't deeply, you know, feel for people that have been hurt and feel for drug addicts that can't get clean and things like this. I do, but when someone asks me how did I feel at the time, nothing is how I felt, literally nothing. And that is scary in itself, because it left me thinking I was just invincible. Oh, well, I've seen someone get killed over there. I've seen this person get shot. I've seen this person have acid thrown at them, like, and nothing. And it used to worry me in my later life, like, oh God, I'm not feeling anything. But so, yeah, it's sort of a stupid answer, but nothing. And the monotony that Robin was talking about in, like, the time where I was in country, it was true. It was hard to, like, pull anything out of that, because it was just days on end just rolling into each other of the same faces, the same, just the same process, the same streets, the same everything. So, yeah, it just becomes a blur, literally.
I think the other thing is, to some extent, because I think Danielle was quite at the vanguard, really, of County Lines. In some respects, in country, they had it quite easy in some ways. And this is, again, where the story kind of defied expectation, because I was thinking, you know, turf wars and, you know, gang rivals, and there was going to be, like, street battles and stuff like that. And when I came to ask Danielle about it, it was more, that didn't really happen. And they had... they were kind of left alone, really, and, you know, and police to for the most part weren't really onto them. They didn't have rival gangs to struggle with, So there wasn't that kind of that level of conflict that I was perhaps that I was expecting. Yeah,
that's actually one of the points I'm going to draw upon is the way that County Lines, and again, you were doing this before, it's called County Lines, the way the process worked, you so noticed the difference, Danielle, in between what the Metropolitan Police were like and to what local town police were like. You so picked up on that difference. So what are those differences? What did you see then?
The Met Police and, like, especially, like, robbery squad, gang unit, was, like, not serious police. We didn't see them as, like, serious police officers, but they knew exactly what we was doing. It was a cat and mouse game. And someone said to me, it's not, we need to be lucky every single day and they just need to be lucky on one day. And that was, like, our level of, like, police awareness was heightened in London. Not to say it wasn't heightened in country, because in country, you're naturally, everything's on edge. But the country police, just, no disrespect to them, but I just don't think they knew what was going on. They didn't have, like, a full grasp of what was going on. So it was easy for us to fly under the radar at them times. And I mean, now I would say it's not the same. I think they've got a good hold on what country County Lines is, and they know how to spot it a bit more now. But back then, we were just literally free as birds up there. Like, the police would stop us, potentially because there was black males in the car and the area was quite a Caucasian area. But literally, if we had our story, which was we were here to visit family, and they let us go on our way. There was no resistance from them.
Can you explain, because there will be people that listen to this that don't know what County Lines and Country is. So what is that process?
Country, for me and for us, was just going outside of our area, London, and travelling to a countryside location. We used to specifically target rehab towns, like, for instance, Bournemouth. There's a lot of rehab centres there. So that is, like, prime location for us to go to. And the reason I personally think we were going to the countryside was because there's less police. There's more drug addicts. Well, I wouldn't say more drug addicts, but there's more drug addicts in plain sight that are easier to get to. And you get away from, like, the conflict in your local area. Normally, the way it works is wherever you're based in London, you would go. So say, like, the South Londoners, they may be round there. The East Londoners might go to Ipswich. The West Londoners might go to Cardiff. You know, like, you're going whatever your nearest M-way is. Yeah.
Robin, this must have been weird for you. So when the pieces started moving together to you and you started realising that what County Lines is, you said yourself that you wanted a human to explain what County Lines is about. Presumably, you found that in Danielle, and that her story can project out to the wider. How confident are you that we can get more of an understanding of the root causes? Not just, you know, not just what County Lines is, but why it happens, why people do have an enterprise that they can get to. How confident are you that we can actually start to properly understand this?
I think it's absolutely essential, because all the messaging really is kind of top-down messaging. It's, you know, stuff about policy, it's statistics, you know, there's this percentage of girls in gangs, there's this percentage of kids doing, and it's all, we need to hear bottom-up messages. We need to hear voices like Danielle's, so that you can, you know, begin to understand why and how they've got into it. I mean, Danielle gives a clear roadmap of, you know, all the things to avoid, all the pitfalls to avoid for you know, kids and parents. So I think it's absolutely essential. And the more voices like Danielle's we hear, the better. I think the problem is probably not everyone is going to be as confident and as able to express what they've been through as Danielle is. And that's, you know, partly because of her education, partly because of the fact that she's been advocating for people who've been through similar experiences. So, yeah, we need to hear more people like Danielle.
I was just going to like jump on the back of that and say, like, I was speaking to someone at a work event the other day, and this person, I can't say their job, but they're high up in the criminal justice world. And I'd done a little speech, and she came to ask me for a picture afterwards, and she wanted to speak to me. So I said, that's fine. And one of the first questions she asked me was, oh, you were in a gang. Was it a black gang? And I was like, that is the most ignorant comment I've ever heard in my, like, literally, I had to tell her about herself, because I was like, I don't know where you've even got that message from, like, that gangs are split into colours and things like that. I never experienced that. And I told her, like, I don't have any experience of a black gang. I have an experience of a London gang. There was multiple ethnicities, multiple racists involved in what I was doing. And it just shows that there is like a baseline of just ignorance to this problem. And that is why they're never going to solve it if they're not opening their minds to the truth.
That really nicely leads me to one of the points I wanted to make, is that one of the issues that we're dealing with is arbitrary stop and search. You know, the fact that BAME communities are absolutely, I think it's around 8 times more likely at the moment. You knew this at the time. You knew that there was a lot more emphasis on BAME communities and people of background. And you kind of almost used it to your advantage, didn't you? Of, well, let's exploit that gap. So what was that like, being so aware of discrimination, but also being able to use it positively for your own gain?
I wouldn't say it was me that identified that. I would say it was someone else. And they literally said, like, listen, you're white, you're a girl, you're going to be fine. And it's that has kind of been the truth ever since I've started. Like, I have been, you know, when I was driving in country, they would look at me, the police would look at me and just assume, oh, she's a white girl, she's not wearing a tracksuit, she must be fine. And the reality was far from that. So I think, yeah, it wasn't so easy in London, because I think the police there were more clued up to, it's not necessarily the colour of your skin or your ethnicity, but it's more the area that you're in. So for instance, I've got over 300 stop and search sheets, which they used to give out for when I was stopped. I used to get stopped sometimes twice a day, just going about my normal day. So it wasn't, yeah, the BAME thing was, it was great, like, in terms of, like, using it to be undetected in country, but I wasn't able to use the white female thing so much in my area.
Your experience of the police in general, Danielle, has been extremely interesting, because there's certainly some incidents that have happened to you that you have been let down, comprehensively let down by the system. Do you ever recover from that? Do you ever get a respect back for authority, as it were? Or what is your relationship now with services and the police?
Oh, it's a hard question. Like, I'm still hardwired that I don't talk to the police. I don't want police involvement. I don't think they can help me. Like, that is just hardwired in my brain. But now I understand more that they're just doing their job. Whereas before, I actively had a passion for, like, hatred towards the police. Now I don't. Like, now I am respectful. It's funny, because I actually got stopped yesterday. So, yeah, so that was fun. And it makes me, like, when I got pulled, I was physically shaking, because it's been a long time since I've had any dealings with the police. And I just remember how horrible it was back then. And it literally had, like, a physical effect on me now. So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, they do great work. But I think, again, there's not much understanding, and the criminal justice system is against some people. So, yeah, that's sort of something I would like to change in the future if I could.
And we're going to start to wrap up now, because you've both been really patient. But one of the things that stands out from the book as well is that I think it's fair to say that you start to get a liking to the lifestyle in what the financial gain was, because you had shopping sprees, you know, certain clothing items mattered. At one point, you were shopping in Harrods and things like that. The process of that in itself, what was that like, to have money in your pocket and being able to buy? There was a rule of three as well that you got taught by a fellow dealer of, can you buy three of something? If not, you can't afford it. So there was some really prudent financial advice that goes on. You know, it's not just a case of like what some people imagine, oh, it's all drug dealing, it's all feral. No, these are actual people that have got morals, have got nous. The whole process is within that. It's a broad question, but what was it like?
It was like, in terms of spending money, it's great. I worked hard for that money. I was up all hours. I've slept for 2 hours, and this is my money. I've worked hard. And so, you know, I would spend it, but I've always, because of like my background where I didn't have much, I've always been like a saver anyway. And the people that I was around actually had huge business acumen. They were great business people. So there was always like a heavy emphasis on saving your money. And I think in this drug game, everyone knows this is not for life. It's like you're an athlete. It's only for a certain time span. So you better make it, make as much as you can, and invest it and do something else. So that was kind of always in the back of my mind. So even though the spending was like frivolous, maybe, I had money and I could do that, and I still had my savings. So yeah, I learned a lot and I bought a lot of nice things. But the truth of the matter is I didn't leave with any of those nice things, you know. So was it really worth it? That's for people to make their mind up, I guess.
And that brings me to a really good point that I'd like to make, is that you decided to exit this, and it was a quick decision. You know, it wasn't, there was a lot of building up to that decision from what I read, but that process of you going, right, this is it, I want to exit the life. When you did make that decision, it must have been difficult, surely.
Yeah, it was horrific. And like, it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. Like, you have to remember, these are my family members. It's like leaving your family, leaving your area. This is all I've ever known. Like, I'm good at this job. This is the best I've ever done. I'm excelling at this job, and I now have to leave it and start from scratch. People don't understand, you know, it's easy to move someone out of their local area, but you're leaving them with no money, no friends, no support. So there's so many things to think about. And yeah, it was hugely difficult. And to be honest, I mean, in the book, it touches on it a little bit, but I literally went straight back to selling drugs just for someone else straight away, because I couldn't live without it. Like, they used to say, oh, a drug dealer's addicted to drug dealing because they're actually addicted to the drugs. And it always used to make me think, like, because we're around so many drugs, are we physically addicted to drug dealing? And it always made me think, like, maybe it's that, because even after I left, I still wanted to do that for quite a while. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's just moving out of an area. That's like a drop in the ocean of what you've got to address if you're trying to leave like a life of drug dealing.
There's a few people that seem to have been very key in your process to move away from the lifestyle. That's both your friend, but also some of the workers that were actually good within the process. How important are those figures, whether they're mentors, friends, guiding lights? Would you be here without those people?
No, probably not. I don't think at the time I had like the self-resilience to do all of that by myself. I think, bearing in mind, it was such a new problem to them, and I was one of the first girls they actually helped out of the gang, a gang. So they were quite uneducated in it as well. And, you know, there's definitely room for improvement in those services. But just having people to, I think it was just having people to talk to, because the truth is they didn't understand what I was going through. They didn't understand what I needed. But just having strong, independent women that I could look up to was great. And it showed me, all I ever knew was selling drugs. So to see someone doing something else was great, and it gave me a bit of a push.
How important do you think it is, Robin, that someone like Danielle educates the services?
Yeah, again, absolutely essential, because, you know, how can they devise a pathway out without knowing what she's trying to exit, or what someone like Danielle is trying to get out of? You know, how can they understand that kind of family connection, that family bond? How could they understand that, say, Danielle had all her finances were tied up in, you know, in the gang or the community of people that she was working with, the fact that they were paying for a flat and a car, the fact that she didn't know how to you know, apply for benefits or be on benefits, or how to live without £1,000-£2,000 a week coming in. So all that, absolutely essential, because it helps them devise a pathway and helps them understand what people who are involved in these gangs or in these communities of people are going through, and what they need to get out of them, what they need to extricate from themselves from that situation.
So we always talk in terms of tackling county lawyers and the dealers, but is it more in terms that we need to actually be responsive, listen, and, as you said, have a holistic approach, you know, actually take lived experience as a cherished matter?
Yeah, I think there's it's an easy way to talk about, isn't it? To talk about what we refer to as the drugs problem. And, you know, is it really the drugs problem? Is it an austerity problem? Is it an inequality problem? Is it a lack of opportunity problem? All these things. So, it's an easy way out, isn't it, for authorities to kind of blame everything on the drug problem and talk about it as though it's something isolated in its own little bubble, when really it's kind of symptomatic of probably a much deeper society-wide malaise, really.
So this is going to put you both on the spot. I'm going to ask you both the same question and start with you, Robin, first. There's always a lot of call for evidence. At the moment, there's an inquiry going on into drugs. If you was to give evidence of how we can do things differently, what would be your testimony?
I think we need to hear from more people like Danielle. I think we need much better messaging from the people above us, from lawmakers, from people in positions of authority, and people in positions of financial power. Because, you know, when you've got people in some of the highest offices of the land telling us all to do one thing and then doing something completely different themselves, and when they're caught, they just kind of lie and bluster the way out of it. You know, when you've got furlough fraudsters hoovering up £4.5 billion in furlough fraud, you know, using made up directors' names like, Adolf Tooferry Hitler. You know, this is real stuff. I'm not making this up. When you've got millions and millions of pounds handed over to government cronies in PPE contracts and nothing happens. When you've got banks, some of which are household names, laundering billions of pounds for Mexican drug cartels and nothing happens. You've got all this, you know, what we call white collar crime. It's not white collar crime. It's just crime. It's no different to what someone like Danielle was doing. In fact, it's more insidious and more dangerous, I think. So when you've got all these examples set, you know, what are young people supposed to take from that? What are the rest of us supposed to take from that? Well, what they take from it is what Danielle did, which is, I'm going to go get my money, and I don't care how I do it. I'm going to get my money. You're not going to stand in a shop for 9 hours a day earning £9 an hour when you've got this opportunity on your doorstep, when everyone else above you is doing exactly the same thing, but wearing a tie and with a briefcase. So I think we need much better messaging from you know, authorities and people in power.
It's such an important point to make, because what's going on right now is we've got a name and shame drug policy coming through, both from the Conservatives and Labour. But the thing is that they fail to mention is that it's firmly on record, the amount of cabinet members and shadow cabinet members that consume drugs, and yet their chances aren't being inhibited in life. And it always falls to people like Danielle that come from certain backgrounds that has the emphasis put on them. So would you say this is a class war as well?
I think, well, the other thing I was going to say is while you've got that message, while they're, you've been bombarded with that messaging. At the same time, being bombarded with messaging that's telling you to consume, that your standing in society is measured by what shoes you wear, by the car that you drive, by how big your house is, how much money you've got. You know, how different would our society be if your status was measured in terms of how much you care? You know, Henry Blake, who directed the County Lines film, he hit the nail on the head saying we all need to care more if we're to solve this.
And I'm going to ask you the same question, Danielle. So you're now in office, which, by the way, I would champion that. Please run for office. What would be your testimony in how we can do things differently? What would you say to policymakers?
I'm just saying, like, let's be more trauma-informed out here, because this is not the right way. We should not be criminalising people that are struggling. Like, let's just help them, because I just think realistically, street drug dealers are the lowest, you know, in that food chain. We're the end of the line. It don't go any further. It stops with us. So, yeah, great. That's fine. Like, tackle drugs. Great. Amazing. Do tackle drugs. But tackle, you know, the huge importers and things like that, because we're the end of the line. And we're the ones that are suffering. We're the ones that are dealing with the violence that may come with that sort of profession. We're dealing with the everyday trauma. So, yeah, when you've got maybe someone in a police station that has been found with a few heroin wraps on them, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, it's a criminal offence, do something, but I don't think jail is the right option here. There's far too many, you know, small-time drug dealers in jail and not enough sexual assault perpetrators in prison. So I just think we're targeting the wrong things. And if we change society as a whole, maybe low-level drug dealers will not even get into it in the first place. And just be more, I think it's a very aggressive approach they've got to, like, gangs. But let's look at the other side of it. Like, these are people that, this is their family, this is their only support system. And yes, I'm not denying that there's not violence entrenched in that life, but I still think we need to be trauma informed when dealing with it, instead of being like aggressive with arrests and stop and searches and things like that.
Just as one more final wrap up point, the mental health thing runs right the way through the book, and especially with everything you've been through and seen. And you just mentioned there that because of an incident yesterday, you know, it all came back. May I ask what your mental health is like at the moment? And is there ways that you can personally set about making things better for yourself? You know, how are you feeling, basically?
I'm fabulous. Like, I'm good. You know, I smile every day. I laugh every day. I've got passion for life. I want to make things, like, I want to make a great life for myself. But I still, like, the whole not feeling emotions thing is very real. I have zero emotions. Like, nothing phases me, nothing bothers me, like, literally nothing. So it's just, and that's quite, it's still quite scary to feel nothing. Like, I know it sounds great, like, oh, you know, I could go through the worst thing and not feel anything, but it's actually quite scary. So, yeah, that's the only thing I'm trying to tackle at the moment. But in terms of, like, life, I'm in the best place I've ever been. Like, and people have said to me, oh, because of your experience, you know, like, are you scared to go outside? Are you scared of men and things, questions like that? And the answer is no. Like, I, you know, I have a great partner, I have great friends, and I just hope that this book can maybe just go to a few people and, you know, open their eyes to what's going on their doorstep. And at the end of the day, just let's just all be kind to each other.
That's perfect. Well, thank you both so much for talking to me. I really, really want
You're
people
welcome.
To read this book. Is there any other points that you want to get in?
Oh, so many points. There's so many to say, so much to say on this topic. Like, it's such a massive topic and there's so many elements to it. But yeah, for me, like, it was very hard to put my life into someone else's hands to write my story. And I'm just really thankful that Robin's done a great job and it's come across. The response I'm getting is that it's coming across very truthful and very sincere, and That's what I wanted. I didn't ever want to feel like I'm bragging or that I'm a victim. I just wanted to say my truth as it was. And yeah, I'm happy. I feel like the book has done that.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining in. Please go find Top Girl. You do need to read it for yourself because this podcast doesn't do it justice. It is really well written. And that's all credit to Robin. And it is really well told. And that is all credit to Danielle. Her life story is cinematic. It really is. Thank you so much, both of you, for participating in this podcast. And on the thank you to Nikki, the executive producer of this show. He is incredible. He's the workhorse. He does everything. Thank you to the associate producers of John and Tristan. Thank you for everything you do. Thank you for you, the listeners. Please click, like, share, subscribe, all of that things. It really helps us get the messaging out there. Thank you to My Name is Ad for the artwork. Thank you to Scroobius Pip and the whole Distraction Pieces Network. We've got so much more to come on this podcast on Stop and Search. Please keep listening. It all helps. And we'll see you soon. Thank you so much. Bye. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Which way you seldom stray.